the Good Things Foundation has identified several cross-cutting barriers to digital inclusion, and those manifest differently in the lives of people who are already disadvantaged, so whether that's their age or income or education level. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how this happens specifically in the UK, which populations within the UK are at the greatest risk of digital exclusion and why that may be.
I think I'm going to kind of, I suppose, approach this in thinking also about the next question as well. And I suppose it's just a few different reflections here. So one of these is that when we're doing our advocacy work, we talk about fixing the digital divide. Actually, what we also know from the research is that there isn't a binary, you are included, you are excluded. This is really about a spectrum of experiences. And when we talk, therefore, about digital exclusion or digital inclusion, you're talking about needing to have a number of different things in play at the same time, and these are interconnected. And this relates to the question about barriers, because for some people, the primary or maybe even the sole barrier might be that they cannot afford the level of internet connectivity or a suitable device. Whereas for other people, their issue may less be about affordability of internet access, but it may be more about not having the skills and the confidence or then the support to be able to build those things up. And therefore, we can talk about how age, older age, is still the strongest predictor of not being online or only using the internet in a limited way. And for some people in that older age category, it might be a big issue around cost, but for some it might be more about confidence and skills or not having access to the support that means that they're able to use that. So we keep, I think, cycling back to both you need all of these different elements. So, you know, data connectivity is pointless without a suitable device, which is pointless without the digital skills and confidence, which is pointless without data connectivity. So there's something called the pointless triangle, which one of our data poverty lab fellows, Kat Dixon, developed. But that links into this point about the barriers manifesting, and they can manifest at all different ages, and particularly because there is a cost of living crisis going on at the moment within the UK and across other parts of the world as well. Actually, that means that we are seeing a rise in the number of people for whom their internet access and use will be affected more by affordability. And that also compounding things for people for whom it might also be lower educational attainment. There might be other barriers around the device not being suitable and accessible in terms of reasonable adjustments, accessibility settings, or not being able to afford the extra kit that might be needed for, say, a disabled person to be able to use that device. So it becomes quite, challenging to separate, and there is a risk that we make big assumptions of older people, young people. I think the other thing that I feel is important here is that, for example, when you're talking about migrant status, so there can be a number of different barriers there. Some of those may be that people who may be refugees or are still seeking asylum may not have the resources to be able to get the data connectivity or the devices they need. Some of that may be actually language barriers. So there might not be skills barriers in terms of using the internet, maybe to connect with people from, either within the UK or from outside the UK. But the language barrier might be a problem in terms of navigating English language online essential services, like government services. So again, it's more complicated than this being about status itself, but there can also be barriers in terms of levels of trust and confidence in how personal data will be used. For example, if you are, you know, if you're going through seeking asylum in the UK, that can create added concerns about how your data might be used. So I think at a high level, we can see clear correlations between digital inequalities and inequalities around social, economic, health inequalities as well. But the reality is more nuanced than that and is more of a spectrum of experiences than that as well. And that then leads into the holistic approach to digital inclusion and why you do need to be understanding the whole package of support that someone might need to then be able to be digitally included. And that links to some other research that we've been involved with, which is around the minimum digital living standard. This is a really, I think this is will be a really valuable piece of research for you to point to. Mm-hmm. And I can share the links for this. So I suppose that, you know, it's great that that UK is ranking so high, but there is still a really clear level of digital inequalities, as we've kind of been talking about. And actually, we still lack a very clear shared understanding of what good looks like and an understanding that reflects that more holistic approach. So we've been involved in a proof of concept feasibility study, which is being funded by an independent charitable foundation called the Nuffield Foundation. And that is a partnership with the University of Liverpool and Loughborough University and City University and some others. And that is using a methodology called the minimum income standard methodology, which has been used for over 10 years to establish through a series of deliberative consultations with members of the public about what is in the minimum basket that a household, a particular household type, needs for a minimum but acceptable standard of living in the UK. So it's a different kind of approach to within the poverty field and the inequalities field. It's a different, more bottom-up approach to defining living standards. And that goes through real detail, like, you know, how many toothbrushes, how many pairs of winter shoes or winter coats would you need for a household with children, et cetera, et cetera. So that methodology and that team brought them together with digital inclusion experts to ask the question about what should be in the minimum basket of digital goods and services and skills and understanding that the proof of concept is a household type with dependent school-aged children. And so that has been about defining a minimum digital living standard and then the contents, the different goods and services and skills that members of the public themselves feel is needed now. So it's not a top-down approach, it's very much a bottom-up approach. And we've just published the findings of what should be in that contents for a minimum digital living standard for households with children. And it includes everything from how many devices, what level of devices, you know, thinking about broadband, thinking about mobile data, thinking about the essential skills you might need, around practical functional skills, but also then around managing risk, online risk and harms. And so that's all been brought together. And that feels really, really important, both because it reflects that holistic approach. It reflects what households themselves are saying is now needed. And so there is an element then of cultural norms, because I'm quite clear as well that in terms of world rankings, it's not only about, you know, the level of digital inequalities also relates to the assumptions and expectations about how important it is to be online. Mm-hmm. So if where you are living in the world, being able to, you know, use the internet for your education is directly linked to that now becoming so prevalent in a school child's life, or in the interactions a parent has with their school around their children's education, if that is now so normative and place, that not having access to that consistently, reliably, confidently creates a barrier for education. That's quite different compared to other settings where the use of internet in terms of everyday interactions between a school and a parent and a child is less well established. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's quite interesting because I think this is where also some of these trends and some of the issues around digital inequality are thrown into particularly sharp relief in the United Kingdom, almost because we've got such an acceleration happening around the channel shift to digital with regard to essential public services and essential health services. So the stakes are higher, which is where we're worried that people will be left further behind and that that divide will be deepening as well as potentially broadening. So I just wanted to really mention that research as well, because I think all of that feeds into both our understanding of the importance of a holistic approach, how that manifests for people themselves, but also then how responses from organisations like ours are about making sure there is that holistic support in place. And so that's why we talk more and more about needing to grow the national social infrastructure for digital inclusion, which needs to sit alongside the, you know, the broadband full fibre, the coverage, you know, that kind of more physical infrastructure. We really need that social infrastructure in place. And rolling back then to whether you're talking about rural or urban, that infrastructure needs to be in place regardless. And so in a way, with the minimum digital living standard, wanting to establish and say this is what a household needs, it then means that the responses to that may have to be different in some rural areas, in some urban areas, with some particular groups. So for example, thinking about a household with disabled children or a household with a disabled family member, adult or child, what they need to be able to meet that minimum, there might be additional or different support or equipment that they need, but still those needs are likely to be the same. So similarly in a rural area, there may be additional, like you may need additional support or the broadband might need to be faster, etc., but still those needs are the same. It's like how you meet them that is then different.
One thing that I thought of when you were mentioning the minimum digital living standard is this idea of meaningful connectivity, which has really sort of become a buzzword in the past few years. People are realizing having the device is not enough. Having a connection is not enough. The connection needs to be strong. It needs to be consistent. The device needs to be updated and you have to be able to maintain the device. And then once you have that, you need the skills to be on it safely and effectively.
Absolutely.
I'll definitely have a look into that research that you mentioned, because that's really interesting that you're actually building that from the bottom up and you're asking people, what do you think is the minimum, as opposed to saying, this is what we think should be the minimum and then we're going to try and meet it.
Yeah, exactly. And it is really interesting because what I anticipate happening is there will inevitably be questions from people going, why isn't this in there? Why isn't that in there? You know, which is great. Part of this is about stimulating conversation. But also we've already had questions about, you know, we did, for example, we really, there was a lot of debate around how best to frame what households need in terms of, for example, broadband connectivity. And where we got to wasn't saying, okay, this is the, you know, it's 10, 30, 60, 100 megabits per second. Where we got to was saying, actually, do you know what? Families are saying they need for everyone to be able to be on the internet at the same time for what they need to do. And there is no one number you can put to that, because also people's experiences, depending on where you are in the country as well, you can't always necessarily reliably get that experience through what some providers might say is the, you know, this is the, you know, number of megabits per second you need, you know. So we went round and round in circles, and in the end we decided actually it has to be about that, you know, that articulation of this is what people want to be able to do. We're not going to slap a number on this, because actually that number also will change over time, and it will vary depending on where you are in the country. In some places, you know, 60 megabits per second might be fine. In other places, you might actually, that might still give you a lag experience, or, you know. So, yeah. So I think it's a really interesting one, that it does fit in with, I think, meaningful connectivity. Mm-hmm. And that links in with the definition. A minimum digital standard of living includes, but is more than, having accessible internet, adequate equipment, and the skills, knowledge, and support people need. It is about being able to communicate, connect, and engage with opportunities safely and with confidence. So it's quite, you can see how there's so many different things within that. Mm-hmm. We deliberately don't have affordable in there, because actually the affordability is one of those of how you meet it and the barriers people have to meeting it. Whereas, and we kind of reflected, as soon as you have like affordable internet, one person's affordable is not necessarily another person's affordable. So that definition was where the team arrived at through a series of orientation groups with members of the public from different household types, older, younger, some with children, some without children. What is it that they're saying is really important? And then trying to distill that into something. And that definition was then tested out in the next stage of deliberative groups with members of the public, and then refined, and, you know, and so that's where we are at the moment with it. And it really resonates, I think, really links in with what you're saying about it's meaningful connectivity. It's not just about a basic connection and a basic device.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think especially due to the pandemic, which kind of leads into my next question, the stakes are a lot higher. Digital learning became mainstream and people teleworked and governments moved their services online. Telehealth and things like that became the norm. And even though we became a more digital society, people's level of essential digital skills, the gap actually widened between people who had the essential digital skills and who didn't.
So one of the visuals that quite often we have something called the Digital Nation, which is a very simple visual, which brings up some of the key data. And it's a way of us every year updating using existing available national data sets to give a sense of this is where we're at on digital inclusion. And one of the things that I sometimes feature when I show that slide is a big red curve going through it, talking about something called the Matthew effect, which you may have heard of. It's a kind of sociological term, and it basically is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So digital is one of those classic, it's neither inherently good or inherently bad. We know that there are kind of risks out there as well as benefits. But what it means is that almost the more you have, the money to be able to afford the unlimited, the fast connectivity, the skills and the education to be able to use it, to be able to navigate it, use it for work. So the more you have, actually, the more opportunities, as you're saying, then open up for you. Whereas the less you have, the more you are then getting locked out. And even if you stay in one place, the digital world is progressing, the opportunities online are growing for your earning power, for your ability to save, your ability to get better deals, your ability to connect, to access, as you say, health, education, learning, all of those things. And so that means that gap is widening then. And so I think it's also then really about being able to understand people's experiences within that context as well. So at the moment, in terms of things like the cost of living crisis, or during the pandemic as well, you know, if you were online, it was much easier for you to be able to access essential information, trusted support, you know, a lot of information was then moving online. And so that just makes life bluntly really hard for you if you are not now online. And of course, we don't see any of that stopping. I think the point around older people, there are lots of different things happening at the same time. And that will have been the same for older people during the pandemic, where if you are particularly an older person living alone, then that would make it harder for you to be able to get the support you need to be able to use the internet and to do so independently or confidently. The data from Ofcom, the regulator, indicated that there are more people who are making who are using proxies. So often that's family and friends. It could be community organisations, libraries, etc., who are also providing you that support. I think this is where some of what we see around digital inclusion gets complicated, because sometimes you can see an increase in use of online services across lots of different age groups, but actually some of that can be being done by other people, not necessarily independently being done. But what you also then have is you also have people who fall back from using online platforms because they then have less access to support. And some of that can happen, especially in older age, through things like people acquiring a health condition or an impairment, things like loss of dexterity in your fingers. That's a really great example of if you experience some of those barriers as a result of older age, you might be less likely to tap into support that is available for people who may be younger adults with disabilities, who might have tapped into support around assistive technology that is really enabling. But it's a classic thing of, you know, either if you're a child or a student or a working age adult, you might be tapping into support around assistive tech in a way that you're not aware of it as you age. So I think some of the issues around people, I suppose sometimes it's called lapsed use, where as you are older, your skills and confidence may decline. That might be as a result of cognitive or other physical or sensory barriers, and not then being aware of or accessing the support around that. But it might also be as a result of, they're a really good example, an example of someone who may have used IT at work, but then after retirement, you don't then have the IT support, the systems in place, you just start to use it less, you're devices get less up to date, you become less confident, and so actually you're on a spiral down because you don't have the support that you previously had. But I think some of the other insights that are really interesting are about kind of the link between limited use and then being able to navigate and avoid online harms. So that's another big factor for people, is their fear and worry about things going wrong, about fraud, scams, all the kind of risks of being on the internet. And the impacts of that can be even greater if you are a less confident internet user. And the likelihood of that can also be greater if you're using the internet less often, which actually means you're less aware or informed about kind of how to work out if you can trust a specific site, for example. So I think that's the other interesting thing here that kind of means that some of the gaps for some groups can widen, where actually what they really need is more of that face-to-face and at elbow support, either from family members or from community organisations or libraries, to be able to keep pace with the changes in digital technology. And of course, the pandemic did mean that some of those support systems were just not available for people in the same way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And as you were mentioning the situation with more elderly individuals, it kind of reminded me of that terminology of digital immigrant, digital native. And when you're a digital immigrant, you're learning the language of digital later in life. And so you're at greater risk of losing those skills. Similarly to if you learn a language when you're in your 40s, you're more likely to forget it than someone who maybe learned it when they were five. That's true.
But I think part of the barrier I think we now face is that even terms like digital native can end up being unhelpful, because they can compound assumptions that, for example, if you are 20 years old today, you have been born in a digital world. If you are 20 years old today and you struggled at school and you don't have a lot of income, and yes, you may have enough to be able to get a smartphone, or you may be an expert gamer and use gaming and so, you know, interact through gaming, but that doesn't mean you have the transferable digital skills and confidence to use that in to find work, to seek healthcare access online, to actually use it within the workplace as well and be part of a remote or hybrid digital economy. So I think that is uniquely where we are at the moment, is both COVID has accelerated digitalization, of course, across every area of our life, and none of that is going to stop, but also the risk is that everyone is making assumptions that everyone now is digitally included, and therefore online services aren't being designed in the way that they could and should be, to think, am I designing this online service for people who may have lower literacy levels, who may face language barriers, who may run out of data halfway through? Have I thought about that? If someone is only accessing the service on a mobile phone with pay-as-you-go data. So I think that as well is where some of these risks really, really come in. And certainly then, going back to the digital immigrant point, one of the challenges, I think, is if you're learning a new language, part of what is brilliant around digital is that there is the opportunity for constant improvement and responding to how people are using and interacting. But actually also some of that is incredibly challenging for people who feel, oh, I've learned this way, I've learned how this looks, and now I go back into this service and this system and it looks really different. And even things that are improvements because they're making it safer for us then become barriers. You know, if two-factor authentication means I need this device and another device, that is added cost to me, that is added complexity, and yes, it is added security, which is brilliant and fine if you've got the skills and the devices and the, but so that's the other thing, which I think means that it just feels like this never feels like it gets easier for some people. And for other people, they'll get it, they're motivated, it opens doors. No matter what age you are, you know, there are examples of 90-year-olds going, I never thought I'd do this, now it's opened my world, I love this. They're total advocates for digital inclusion, supporting their friends and, you know, in community groups, volunteering around this. And other people who just feel, oh my gosh, now I've got to do it this way, now I've got to do this, and it can feel really hard work for people too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That's a really interesting point. Thank you for bringing that up, and also bringing up the design part of it, where the people who are creating these applications or devices, they're usually in economically advantaged situation. Yeah. They're usually well-educated. They usually have, you know, a wealth of knowledge and strong connectivity to the internet and things like that. So maybe they're not thinking about, you know, not everyone who's going to be using this device is in the same position as me, and that can become really harmful.
Exactly. So we talk, whilst our work is very much focused on supporting community organisations so they can respond to local need and think about that in terms of those essentials of skills, device and data connectivity. We also do have conversations with people literally, you know, encouraging and reminding a kind of inclusive by design approach. You know, how can you design better, design more inclusively, and kind of keep that threshold as low as possible to enable as many people as possible to confidently use your online services. And I think that that's an area where there's definitely kind of aspiration and interest in that from people who are within, say, the National Health Service or government digital services. But it's just always reminding, how do you design to make things as inclusive as possible? And it is about inclusion. It's more than website accessibility in terms of, for example, things like screen readers, which obviously that's really, really important. But it's more than that. It's about the usability of websites and of online tools. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. So my next question is a little bit tangential, which was the Economic Case for Digital Inclusion report that was published. And there they actually identify a number saying this is the exact economic return of digitally skilling one person in the UK, which is very interesting because in the NRI, which Portulans Institute publishes, we look at this from an extremely broad stance. We know that involving more people in the digital economy is beneficial, but we don't look at exactly what are those numbers and in what avenues can people be involved in the digital economy. And a lot of those that were identified in this report are almost like indirect ways. Like, you might not be someone who is involved in e-commerce, but by you having the skills to spend online shopping, maybe you're contributing to the economy. So I wanted to ask just if you have any more insights about this report and just any of the key findings that you think are important to take from this report.
Yeah, well, so I mean, it's great that you're reading it, that you're using it. There are kind of two things that I want to say here. So one is both recognizing the value of this, right? So literally being able to say there is a return that comes from investing in digital inclusion of citizens, and even just trying to surface that feels really important in terms of helping to draw the link between an individual having the skills and confidence and the data and devices they need and what that then means for our economy and for our society. However, what we wanted to do was use as much of the pre-existing methodology, because this is an update from one in 2018, because we were really conscious that a lot could have changed during the pandemic. So we kind of thought, we're going through a massive change at the moment. We didn't want to do too much changing of the methodology, because otherwise that could become quite a complicated story. The reason why I'm mentioning that is that we think that actually this is good, but further work needs to be done. And almost what we'd really love to do next time round is to do really quite a big refresh of the methodology. But partly this then goes back to what is available for us to use in order to come to some conclusions around this. So it links to the kind of the data sets that are available and were available for the people at the Centre for Economics and Business Research. So a really good example of this is, we think, and we say so in the report, is this is likely to be a very conservative estimate of the value of digital inclusion to the economy. It doesn't, for example, start to touch on, if you take an area like loneliness, where there have been, where we know that loneliness can really compound people's health. And there's been research that has identified kind of the impact in terms of, you know, people's lives and people's health outcomes. And actually, loneliness doesn't feature here as something that we know can be supported through digital access and inclusion. So there are huge, it feels as though there are several areas. The environment is another one, you know, that there is an indicator there which reflects what the Centre for Economics and Business Research was able to get in terms of data. But we think actually there's a much bigger and more complicated story around the link between digital inclusion, environmental benefits, environmental harms, economic benefits as well. So in a way, what I'd want to say with this is, this feels a really important piece of research. Intuitively, it feels as well that there is benefit to the UK economy and to UK society. However, you know, there's real value in building on this and really thinking about what might be better indicators, you know, what could be used either additionally or instead of some of the indicators that that we have within this. In an ideal world, actually, it's now really time to have quite an overhaul of the methodology and to have another look, given where we are now, as to what is, how do you best make that economic case? And I think some of those indicators will still hold, but I think in other areas there could be better indicators and data sets that we could be using. I think the other thing that that just cycling back to more broadly is, I suppose, a frustration with, you know, with the quality of data that is available at a kind of sufficiently granular level and a national level to be able to talk very clearly about this. So for example, health is a really great example. Is we can see there are correlations between the different indicators of health inequalities and digital inequalities, but there isn't kind of easy access to nationally available data about who is using things like the NHS app, where they are, what they're using these services for. If they're not using the app, is there a link there with them having worse health outcomes or not? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's almost this irony that for all of the data that is collected about us across all the different parts of our lives, it actually isn't that easy to be able to demonstrate a direct link between someone's regular confident use of online services and I suppose their own characteristics or outcomes in other areas of their lives. So I suppose that goes back to the point of these are still proxies, these are indicators.
And this leads me actually to my last question, which I assume this report, the Economic Case for Digital Inclusion, could be potentially used as maybe a policy tool to encourage digital inclusion policy and showing that there is actually a return on it. So I want to ask more generally, what are some of the Good Things Foundation's key policy recommendations that you might be standing behind or that you think would be the most effective in enhancing digital inclusion in the UK?
Yeah. So I'll share several, and they're not in any particular order. One of the key policy recommendations is actually about leadership on this and being able to set a clear vision for what digital inclusion looks like. With the UK government at the moment, we and quite a lot of others from industry and also local authorities, local government, feel frustrated, especially within England, that there hasn't been a refreshed digital inclusion strategy. The last one was written in 2014. And at the moment, there have been a lot of change in the leadership within the UK. And actually, at the moment, there is no clear ministerial leadership on this agenda. And crucially as well, we really want to see more commitment to cross-government department working. So it feels as though this is an area where, you know, digital inclusion is and needs to be everyone's, you know, it's kind of everyone's problem, but no one is really taking responsibility for this. And we need that clear vision, that clear leadership. It's not to say that it is only government's job, but it is to say that there ought to be really strong leadership on this and then resources that follow out from that. Within the UK, some policy happens at a UK level and other policy is devolved to, for example, Scottish government, Welsh government, to combine the authorities. So we need both that kind of leadership, therefore, at all different levels. And that, I think, is where things like the minimum digital living standard come in, because we are saying now that actually we need government to adopt a minimum digital living standard to be able to have that clear benchmark and to say this is what good should look like, and we need a strategy. That should be at the heart of a strategy. I think the other thing that we talk a lot about is recognising that internet access is essential. It's not a nice to have. It is now essential. And with that come different policy recommendations about how we can ensure that that is delivered, especially for those who are otherwise at most risk of not being able to get online or stay connected. And so that's where, in a practical way, we have the National Data Bank around mobile data connectivity, but it's also where we are currently championing for not applying value-added tax to broadband social tariffs. So social tariffs are already discounted tariffs. You have to be in receipt of state benefits in order to be eligible. But for us, that is an example of, you know, there is a difference between how value-added tax is applied to the internet and to broadband compared to, say, electricity or gas or water. And we're saying that even if it is only for discounted tariffs, actually that VAT should be removed. We shouldn't be charging VAT, and we should get... And importantly, that it should be the end customers who get the benefit of that reduction, so to drive down the cost even more. So there's something there around kind of different ways in which we do want to see internet access being genuinely affordable, and you know, especially for those who are in financial difficulties or are on low or very low incomes. There's also something which I think is we've not touched upon so far, but is around devices. Now, one of the things that we do is the National Device Bank, and I suppose our policy ask there is around how can we find a win-win between environmental benefit, social good, social value in fixing the digital divide, and in that area that is around devices. And so what we want to see is more big public sector organisations, government departments taking lead on this, larger corporates looking at their unwanted or unused tech, their devices, laptops, phones, etc., etc., and partnering with us so that those devices can be reused, repurposed, refurbished, as appropriate, depending on the quality of the device, so that those can then be distributed out and given to people for whom having a suitable device is a barrier. So we're piloting that at the moment, but for us, there's a bigger policy ask there, which is, do you know what? Government should be really leading the way in a circular economy, and in terms of thinking about a circular economy and how devices, digital devices, can be used for social good as well as to reduce e-waste. You know, there shouldn't be devices going into landfill unnecessarily where they could be repurposed for social good.
I really, really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and it's been really wonderful. I've learned so much, and I think our audience is really going to enjoy the insights that you have.
Fabulous. Thanks, Sylvie. It's been a real pleasure.